I'm used to introducing the shear. I think at this point I've said a number of times this won't be a conventional shear. If none of the shear are conventional, I don't know. We might have to redefine convention. But we will not be covering an official Mishnah in Pirkei Avos this morning. We're actually going to be reflecting on the absence of a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. We're going to be studying some primary sources together, and we're going to attempt to make a narrative out of those sources. At the end, you may not like the argument, and that's perfectly okay. I'm not sure I accept the argument, and if you don't, at the very least, we have learned some primary sources together. If the narrative arc doesn't fit your prerequisites as to things that you think are true or possibly true, again, I leave that up to you, and we can debate it afterwards. Based on Rabbi Binyamin Lau, the Sage's book that we've referenced throughout, we have been arguing that the messages of Pirkei Avos, these Mishnayos, are eternal, but they're also written by a particular sage in a particular era, and understanding the context of that sage's personality and or era could enhance our understanding of the message. I did not design it this way on purpose, but we happen to be right now in the era of Pirkei Avos that is immediately pre-destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Hillel and Shammai were towards the end of the first century BCE. Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, the students of Hillel, the houses of Hillel and Shammai, begin at around the turn of the millennia and go until the year 70 CE, which is when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. As we will see, there is no Beis Shammai after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Remember that? That's one of the clues that we're going to refer back to perhaps later. But what was going on now during this time period, and did the sages of the time have something to say about it? So, my goal is to supplement the Sunday Shir today on Tisha B'Av as well. So this is a little bit of a plug for Tisha B'Av. We will be learning, we'll have a full day of learning relevant to Tisha B'Av on Tisha B'Av. We start Shacharis at 9 o'clock in the morning. Rabbi Tokayer does an explanatory kinos. And then after the... 8 o'clock? 8 o'clock in the morning. Okay. 8 o'clock in the morning, that might throw off the schedule a little bit, so just refer to the bulletin, not my schedule in my head, not schedule, the actual schedule. So 8 o'clock with explanatory keynotes by Rabbi Tokayer. After the keynotes, which I thought was approximately 11:30, but I guess not. What time would that be? So we'll get you the exact time. After the keynotes, I will be giving a shiur until approximately 1 o'clock. It's going to be a long shear, and it's going to be relevant to this discussion. If you can't make it, I will be posting that hopefully on YU Torah, so you can listen to it online. If you can't listen to it online, you will still be okay if you come back next Sunday and didn't listen to the two shearim that we're doing on Tisha B'Av, because in the afternoon we have a full day of shearim in the afternoon, starting at 2:30. Rachel Weinstein from the Shir will be speaking as well. Rabbi Tokayer will be speaking at 3. Mrs. Shira Boshnik will be speaking at 3:30. I will be speaking at 4, and Rabbi Ruven Boshnik will be speaking at 4:30. My Shir in the afternoon at 4 will also be relevant to these topics. Again, I'll be uploading it. If you can't make it, please listen. If you can't listen, you can come back next week, and you won't be lost in the shirim after that, but I think it would enhance the discussion, it would enhance the ideas. So, we'll get you the exact time of the starting of Shacharis. 8 o'clock. Okay, 8 o'clock Shacharis. I don't know, I always forget what time that translates into the shir starting. Does 11:30 sound too late? No, my shir's not at 12. It starts before that. It's around, I think every year I always forget. I think it's around... I think it's around 11:30 we end up starting the shir, and it goes for around an hour and a half till 1 in the regular shul. Okay, so look in the bulletin. There'll be an email going out tomorrow for the actual full schedule. You can see what the shir topics are, etc. All right, but let's jump back into end of the plug, back into the sources. So, introductory point. Some of you may be familiar, and for some of you it may be your favorite Seder Dvar Torah. I know some people who like this one very much. So Rabbi Akiva is sitting and learning, saying the Haggadah, right? Maisa Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi, anybody remember everybody who's there? Rabbi Tarfon, Lazar ben Azariah, the Sins. Five people sitting in Bnei Brak learning. One of them is Rabbi Akiva, right? And they're learning Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. They're studying, they're repeating, they're reciting Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim until the daybreak, and the students come in and they say, you forgot Kriyas Shema, it's time for Kriyas Shema, let's say, you know, end Seder, start Kriyas Shema, right? So what's the famous conspiracy theory, Dvar Torah, on that Rabbi Akiva story? What were they talking about? Correct, but nobody's heard this before? What were they talking about? So again, this text says they were talking about Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, and on a pshat level, I would say that's probably true what they were actually talking about. There's a conspiracy theory that goes on and says that they were actually talking about the Bar Kokhba rebellion. Now, when's the Bar Kokhba rebellion?
Later.
130, 135, 133, I think is the official date. I don't remember exactly. CE. So we're 200 years after we're talking about right now. But I want to start it off as a paradigm. I'm not saying that that's actually what they were talking about. I wasn't there. I don't know it. The text itself doesn't indicate that. But it's one of those things that people like to say over. With that in mind, that what's really the message? We know Rabbi Akiva was pro Bar Kokhba revolt. That's true, right? And the sources actually talk about that, not that specific source, but as a broad theme, Rabbi Akiva was pro Bar Kokhba, thought there was some messianic underpinnings to it, and supported the revolt and the rebellion wholeheartedly. Now, so let's rewind 200 years. We're preparing for the Great Revolt of the Jews against the Romans, which didn't work out that well. Neither did the Bar Kokhba revolt work out so well. But let's keep this in mind. We're going to table it, keep it in the back of your mind, and look at another point that we want to make. This preamble will be important to the second point, but let's take a step back and go to the first point. So now, jump into source number one. You have two source sheets. One is a formal source sheet, and one's a photocopy. Okay, so take the formal source sheet out. On the top it says Pirkei Avos Lachemar. So this is an excerpt from Lawrence Schiffman, Rabbi Dr. Lawrence Schiffman's book. I'm not related to him. So he has a book that we actually used in Yeshiva Flatbush in the high school for when we learned Jewish history. It's called From Text to Tradition, History of Second Temple and Rabbinic Judaism, published in 1991 by Ktav. So here's an excerpt from it to give a little bit of the historic background. From the accounts available to us, it appears that the Pharisees were the Prushim, those were the more, these were the classic, they're not called rabbis yet, but these are what we would call the rabbis. So the Prushim, the Pharisees, were divided over one of the most burning issues of the period. Some advocated an accommodationist policy toward the government, so long as it allowed them to practice Jewish traditions in the manner required by the Pharisaic view. Others maintained that no government was acceptable, whether controlled by non-Jews or by non-observant Jews, so long as it was not built on the Pharisaic notion of Torah observance, and they called upon their compatriots to rise in revolt. This dispute can be traced throughout the history of the Prushim and continued in Rabbinic Judaism, becoming central in the two Jewish revolts against Rome. So when I said before we're transitioning to the second topic, I lied. This is still the introduction to the first topic. What Rabbi Dr. Schwartz Schiffman is saying is that what was going on at the time? What did the rabbis have to say about the fact that there was a revolt going on, or that there was zealots and there were people killing Jews, killing? We say sinas chinam wasn't because people were laughing at each other for talking in shul or tripping over themselves. There were people killing each other over this revolt. Should we revolt? Should we not revolt against the Romans? He broadens this and says that the Prushim, so even the rabbi section factor, were arguing: do we revolt? Do we not revolt? And when you read this, it's hard not to even impose this on have some modern-day ideas as well, the state of Israel, etc. Let me hold off for a second. Please write down your questions. I do want to hear them, but we got to cover some ground first. So he's saying that they were arguing about this. Who's they? We'll get to. But they, the sages, were arguing about this. Okay, so now let's table that, put it in the back of our heads for a second, and go to source number two. The Gemara in Shabbos says there were four sages who ruled during the time of pre-destruction. Who were these four sages? And it's a broader context of the Gemara. We're just excerpting the point that's important for us. Hatanya, Hillel, number one. So we spoke about Hillel in the previous weeks. Vishimon. We'll have to see who Shimon is. It's not Shimon Gamliel. It's Shimon, comma, Gamliel, comma, Vishimon. So it's four people. Hillel, Shimon, Gamliel, and Shimon. Nahagu Nisiyosan Bifnei Abayis Me'ashana. So they were the 100 years before the destruction of the temple. These four sages ruled. Who are these four sages? So Hillel we know. Look at source number three. Rashi says, Shimon, Rabban Shimon Bino Shel Hillel Hayu. Rabban Shimon was the son of Hillel. Now, some actually connect that Gamliel was the son of Shimon. So he's the grandson of Hillel. And then the next Shimon is the son of... So we have a whole long list of Hillel people. So Hillel's son was Shimon. Now, if we looked in Pirkei Avos, we just did three Mishnayos of Hillel, one of Shammai, and then who's the next Mishnah? You don't have it in front of you. Who's the next Mishnah after Shammai? Rabbi Gamliel. So who did we skip? Shimon, right? The Mishnah after Rabbi Gamliel is the next Shimon, or Shimon ben Gamliel. Right, so we have a Mishnah from Hillel, we have a Mishnah from Gamliel, and we have a Mishnah from Shimon ben Gamliel. We don't have a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos from Shimon ben Hillel. And the question is why? Okay, so why is that? So look at source number four, the Tosefta in Maseches Chagiga. So we all know Hillel and Shammai, yeah, they disagreed, but they seemed to be civil to each other. Shammai was a little bit of a zealot. We know Hillel was more of a humble person. We get that. What about the students of Hillel and Shammai? So, Misharabu Talmidei Shammai beHillel, Shelo Shimshu Kol Tzorchan, there was lots of students, but they did not do their proper due diligence in their studies. So because of that, what happened? Harbu Machlokes beYisrael, V'nasu Shtei Toros. Their machlokas, disputes, proliferated. Everywhere you go, Beis Hillel says this, Beis Shammai says this, we disagree. Hillel and Shammai, how often did they disagree? And we think Hillel and Shammai disagreed all the time. How many disagreements did they have? Four. Possibly five. Beis Hillel, Beis Shammai? I didn't count, but there's lots. I'm not sure if hundreds is the right term, but there's lots and lots and lots of disagreements. So the reflection in the Tosefta here now is that there's two Torah. Now that's a dangerous statement to say, especially when we're Hillel and Shammai, or Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai around. Right? Turn of the millennia, the year zero, right? CE, okay? References to maybe the New Testament here. That's not what they're saying, but it's a dangerous statement to say that it created two Torahs. Right? We have two separate streams now of how do you serve God religiously. It's a pretty extreme statement. Look at source number five. This is a Mishnah in Shabbos, which will be relevant for later. The Mishnah says, and now, Be'elu min ha-halacho sha'amru ba'aliyas Hananya ben Chizkiah. So there was a certain sage who was of the Shammai line, so he was part of Beis Shammai. His name was Hananya ben Chizkiah ben Goryon. Kisha'alu levakro, so everybody went to go visit this rabbi, and they saw Nimnu v'rabu Beis Shammai al Beis Hillel. They saw there was an opportunity here. Majority of the people there in this little meeting were Beis Shammai people. And they said, so now that we have, you know, the majority of Congress, let's pull a vote quickly. Right? So they decided on that day, V'yurches Dvarim Gazru Bo Bayom. So Beis Shammai established 18 different laws according to their view, because they saw they had the majority on that day. And Beis Hillel was on vacation, they didn't get the memo. I don't know what happened. They didn't end up coming. And Beis Shammai made these 18 decrees. What were these 18? And Hananiah was a person from Shammai. What were these 18 decrees? Again, we'll get to that a little bit later. Now, again, so far it's not so crazy. We see just a little bit of intrigue here and trying to get our way versus the other way. Two Toros, again, it's a excitatory statement, but not too crazy. Look at source number 6. This is a Gemara Yerushalmi. And after you hear this, your lives will be changed forever. Okay? So if you don't want to listen, close your ears. Okay? The concept that we have of respecting our sages, and that even Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, okay, they argued, but you know they loved each other. There's a famous Tosefta that says that even though they disagreed, they still married each other. L'shem Shammai is a Mishnah Perkei Avos that says Hillel and Shammai, not Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. So that's an important caveat, because this source number 6, it's mind blowing. So source number 6 says Talmud Yerushalmi, Masechta Shabbos, Perek Aleph. Oso Hayom. The day that Beis Shammai counted themselves and saw that they were the majority and made these 18 decrees, pretty harsh statement, it was as bad as the day of Chet HaEgel. Okay? That's not the crazy part. Tana, Rabbi Yeshua, Onia, Talmidei Beis Shammai, Amdu Lahem Milamata, Vahayu Horgin, B'Talmidei Beis Hillel. Rabbi Yeshua, Onia, reports that Beis Shammai stood on the bottom of this, remember they're in an attic, maybe they're in the first floor. They stood on the first floor, let's say, and they were killing Beis Hillel. Tani, Shisha Mehen Alu, Vashar Amdu Alein Becharabos of Ramathan. They had swords and spears, and they killed Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. Now, Beis Shammai killed Beis Hillel. Some of them, most of them, a lot of them. I don't know how many. Now, before we go too, you know, crazy here, it could be, and Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch makes this argument, that this isn't to be taken literally. Okay? Fine. It's not that easy. I'm okay if you want to hold on to that and say this is all just a bad dream and everybody's okay and everybody loves each other. Fine. Take that. But it's not the end of the sources. There's some other sources that indicate that this might not... I'm not sure if it happened, but the sages at least understood that this was something to be taken seriously and that there was some extreme problem going on here. Look at source number 7. This is taken from the Sefer Hilchos Eretz Yisrael Min HaGeniza. So these are taken from the Cairo Geniza. They found a lot of sources that were buried in Cairo that dated back early to this time period. So this war, we didn't have this until, when was the Cairo Geniza found? A little bit later than that. Somewhere in the middle of the 20th century. So Bishmona, I think. I don't know, you got to look up the... It's somewhere around then. So, but for 2,000 years, we didn't know this source. But it's listing here days that bad things happened. Bishmona, Bishvat, Nergu, Shlosh, Meshisha, Tzadikim, Ba'ai. Okay, so in Ai, lots of people died on the 8th day of Shvat. Bishlosha ve'esrinbo, on the 23rd of Shvat, Nafla Eretz Yisrael Berash. So it's some sort of earthquake, I think. Let's assume that's what it means. Ba'arba ba'adar, Nafla machlokes ben Talmidei Shammai ve'Hillel. On the 4th of Adar, the machlokes between Shammai and Hillel, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, the students of Shammai and Hillel, took place. The Avad Mehen Harbe. And many of them were destroyed. Okay, so there's another source paralleling that there was, this wasn't just a machlokas where we disputed, there was destruction involved. Source number 8. So source number 8 is an interesting law. It's this explicit Shulchan Aruch that says that there were some days that it is proper for us to fast on. Not the main fast days that we know about, some of lesser known fast days that it's brought down explicitly in the Shulchan Aruch, that it's proper, or at least some people fast on them. So in Sif Aleph it says these are the days that Saros happened to our forefathers. Lots of despair, distress happened to them, and it's Roi Lisanos Behem. In Sif Beis, so on the third line, it says, it starts listing off these sad days. Be'echad ben Nisan, Mesu b'nei Aron. So Nadav and Avihu died on the 1st of Nisan. On the 10th of Nisan, Miriam died, and the bear, the well of water, disappeared. And it keeps going. So if you go through this whole list, you're going to see, and we're not going to go through all of it, these are days where famous, important, legendary Jews died. Sad days that happened in Jewish history. The last one on the list. B'tesbo, Tes of Adar, so if you go actually the second to last one, B'zayin Adar, Mes Moshe Rabbeinu, everybody knows on the 7th of Adar, Moshe died. What about on the 9th of Adar? Nechlechu Beis Shammai Beis Hillel. Period. End of statement. Shulchan Aruch says, we fast on the 9th of Adar because Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel disagree. Okay, it's a little bit anticlimactic, right? So I understand it's going in chronological order from Nisan all the way back to Adar. So Adar's the last one. So this is the last day. But it's sort of strange that you're building up with the deaths of all of these famous people. You say, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel had a little bit of a dispute. Right? It doesn't fit. So turn the page, flip the page. What's going on here? Why are we mourning the fact that there was a dispute between Shammai and Hillel? So the Levush in source number 9 gives you a more of a classic explanation and says, "Bitesbo nechleku be Shammai o beis Hillel, ze al ze." So on the 9th of Adar, they fought. And he says, "Behold, the nafla machlokas ben chachmei Yisrael." So since there was dispute, and we know, come on, this is Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, these were tzaddikim, this is L'shem Shammai, and this isn't really such a big deal. But because Mikom Akom Nasis Torah Chas V'Shalom Kishtei Toros, there's this idea that there's two separate types of religious Jewish halachos experiences. Shezeh Oser V'Zeh Matir. He said this is a problem, and he says this is okay. This says it's Tameh. They say it's Torah. So because of that, we fast. And so Levush takes just a classic question. It's a sad day because we don't agree. Okay, that's nice. Still a little bit doesn't add up. Look at source number 10, the Eli Rabbah. Says v'tesbo nechleku v'nehergu gimel alafim min atalmidim. He says this is what we're talking about. He's referring back to the Yerushalmi. He's not referring to the Geniza because this is before the Geniza. But there was a tradition that people were killed. Beis Shammai killed Beis Hillel. I'm perfectly okay if you want to go back to saying this is a metaphor and saying that it's just a machlokes. Fine. But at the very least, there are some sources that indicate that there was actually some actual killing going on here. And this puts in a complete, again, it's mind-boggling, but it definitely puts in a new light, if this is true, sinas chinam, okay? This is not me making fun of you. There's death going on here. Still, it's a little strange. What? I guess you have to process it a little bit. I don't know exactly how we're going to come to a conclusion here, but let's assume it's true for now. What were they so passionate about? Like, okay, I guess Torah, we can get passionate about Torah. We can become zealots for Torah. But killing because you think that's Tameh and I think that's Tahor? So let's put a pin in this and say maybe there was a broader theme going on here. Maybe. Maybe there's something else going on here. So let's look at some more historical background. Look at source number 11. This is Dr. Schiffman again. He has, a pretty good overview of the historical background to the pre-destruction from around the year, I think he starts here with 26 to 70. So it's three bullet points here with three main points. Number one, the early procurators seem to govern wisely and peacefully. So pre-Pontius Pilate in 26, so from around the year Herod died, I think around 4 CE or BC, I don't remember exactly, somewhere around there. And then after that, the Romans started coming in and trying to take over. So he says here in the beginning, that was fine. The Romans set up these governing bodies, there was somebody in charge, and they governed wisely and peacefully, very nice, in the beginning of the turn of the millennia. Now, with the appointment of Pontius Pilate, 26 to 36 CE, the procurator who executed Jesus, conflict and bloodshed began. From that point on, relations deteriorated for a number of reasons. Roman insensitivity to Jewish religious requirements, high taxes, the stationing of troops in Jerusalem,
and the rising messianic yearnings of the Jews. Problems escalated during the reign of the Emperor Caligula in 37 to 41 CE, who demanded that the Jews erect an image of him in the temple. His timely death prevented a tragic and violent confrontation between Rome and the Jewish people. And I'm not sure if we're going to see this, but it's this point is related in source number 13 in a remez. We'll see that a little bit later. But Caligula wanted to put a picture of the emperor in the temple, and the Jews didn't like that. And they said no. And actually, there was an element of everybody getting together. All these different factions who hated each other in the Jewish world got together in order to say, no, we are not putting this up in the Beis HaMikdash. But because of that, he wasn't so happy about that and said that we're going to basically come in and create a war during that time. And what happened was, Josephus reports this, is that he sent the decree, Caligula sent the decree to destroy, to go in and fight the Jews because they didn't want to put that in the temple. And by the time that ship that had that message got lost for 3 weeks, and in between that time, by the time the message came, this guy died. Right? And because of that, the decree never went forth, and there was a little bit of a respite in terms of that. There was no war right then and there. And actually, why not skip to source number 13, Megillus Tynus, which I'll explain a little bit more in what that is later, but at least so you see what I'm talking about here, is a Be'esrin Utrain Bey, Batalt Avidta, the Amar Sagna Lahayasa Lehechalas. So this is written in Aramaic. On the 22nd of Shvat, the abomination, meaning that the idol, that the hated one, meaning Caligula, wished to bring to the temple, was annulled. And on that day, it's such a happy day, it's forbidden to eulogize. So it's referring to this whole thing. So now, back to the bullet point here. We're up to the second bullet point. So soon after, now up to 41 CE, there's a typo here in the book actually, I believe, soon after his ascension as emperor in 41 BCE, I assume that means to say CE, Claudius, who reigned from 41 to 54 CE, appointed Agrippa I, the grandson of Herod and Miriam, as king of the entire land of Israel. So Agrippa was the king. He was a Jewish king. From 41 to 44, Judea was no longer a province, but functioned again as a kingdom. Agrippa loved his people and their ancestral way of life, and sought, within the limits imposed on client states by the Roman emperor, to renew the ancient glory of Israel. He enjoyed widespread support among the Jews, who gave him the same respect and devotion they had given the Hasmoneans, but the non-Jewish residents of the land didn't like him very much. So now we have a little bit of a period now where things aren't as bad. During Agrippa's time, the relationship between the Romans and the Jews wasn't as bad. But next, Agrippa dies. So in the third bullet point, when Agrippa unexpectedly died, the Romans judged his son too young to succeed him and returned Judea to procuratorial rule. From that point on, there was constant strife between the procurators and their Jewish subjects. The Roman officials displayed little concern, either for Judaism and its dictates, or for the economic well-being of the country. Economic decline proceeded quickly, as did the activities of the growing rebel factions. Anarchy was fast approaching, and soon the nation would be aflame with rebellion and then destruction. But here's what's going on historically at the time. You have a little bit of an up and down. You have things are going well in the beginning under Roman rule. Then you have things go downhill under Pontius Pilate. Then they go up a little bit after Caligula dies and Agrippa's appointed. But then Agrippa dies and things go downhill again. And that leaves you, to the destruction. This is basically the last leg, the last 10, 15 years before the destruction. Over the course of Tisha B'Av, we'll talk a little bit more about the immediacy before the destruction. But for now, I think this will get to the point that we need to get to. So there's a lot of problems going on. In terms of the economy, I thought this was actually an interesting point. So remember Herod. What did Herod do? What was one of the things that he did that was successful? Coins. But he put in new renovations to the temple. So you think, like, okay, so they did that, but it's like any contractor. So you get your house, he's going to come to fix your house. You think it's going to be done in a few weeks, months, years. They didn't finish the renovations of the temple until the year, I have it here somewhere, I think it's 63. I don't remember exactly, somewhere in the 60s CE. So this is a few years before the destruction is when they finally finished the renovations. Now, who was building the temple? Who was doing the renovations? You had Jewish workers doing renovations. And now what happened? That it's done. You had tens of thousands of people who didn't have jobs anymore. But just giving a background to the economy at the time. There was this aristocracy who had a lot of money, and we're going to see that on Tisha B'Av, that there's, think about the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, right? So you had people in Yerushalayim who were wealthy, but the masses of people did not have any money. And what happens when you have this, you know, tale of two cities, right? You're going to have, there's going to be problems. You can see the underpinnings of the revolt right here. We have people telling us from the outside how we should worship, what we're allowed to do, what we're not allowed to do. I don't have any money to feed my family, and you're trying to tell me now bring idols into the base. This isn't turning out to be something that's going to end peacefully. And really, this is a buildup. This is a long buildup to the eventual destruction. Now, so if you look at source number 12, here's where we're going to start building our conspiracy theory. So you have, this is the background. And if you don't believe the conspiracy theory, just at least take the sources, and at the very least we've learned sources. If you don't believe the narrative, that's fine. We know that we have this one idea that Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel had this really bad fight, and Beis Shammai killed a lot of Beis Hillel people. I have a book that I actually forgot to bring here. The whole book is based on this premise. Beis Shammai, I guess I'll give the kicker first, instead of building up the suspense, it would be too much for everybody, right? This is an Israeli academic historian, a scholar named Bar Shalom, and Rabbi Lau quotes him. I wanted to see the book inside, so this was this earlier this week. Like, where am I going to get this book now? I'm sitting here in Brooklyn, so I checked all my websites that possibly have free books that you can find online. You know, it's not on Bar Ilan, it's not on Hebrew Books, it's not on Otsar Chachma. So I could go up to the YU library, but I wasn't going up to YU, so it wasn't worth it. So just so you all know, there's another plug here. There's a used bookstore on Quentin and between 32nd and 33rd, run by a nice man, 31st and 32nd, Mizrahi. It's called Mizrahi Books. So he has, like, millions, possibly, definitely hundreds of thousands of used Sfarim, some new Sfarim, all on sale. It's all on eBay also. You can look on eBay. So I went on his website on eBay, and I'm like, please have it, please have it, please have it. And I searched it, and he had it, and I walked over, I got it, and I got the book. Okay, it's called Mizrahi Books, used books. If you, it's not, literally just go on Quentin. It's a storefront.
It's between 31st and 32nd.
It's more than a hole in the wall, because it's more of like a so when you go in, there's just books everywhere piled up, and if you went through it, you would be lost. He has a whole system, and it's all managed online, but he has the attic is filled with books. His first floor is filled with books. And I'm not just saying like one bookshelf, like stacked to the ceiling. Like, his basement is full of books. He rented the basement of the shul next door to him. That's filled with books. And it's over.
You found the book you need.
And I found the book. Because, right, you don't have to know where everything is. He knows. He puts it in the website and it all pops up. Again, go check it out. It's on eBay. You can look what books he has. All right, so back to the main story. So this book of Bar Shalom argues that Beis Shammai, not necessarily Shammai, but Beis Shammai, were zealots. Beis Shammai were in the factions who wanted to revolt, and Beis Hillel were the more pacifist, we don't want to start fights. Take that back to what Rabbi Dr. Shipman said in the first source. This is the Prushim fought about this. This is something that we're not living in a vacuum. There is a war and a revolt going on around us, and it's nice for us to think like, okay, you know, the rabbis lived in a little, I don't even want to think about that. That's not a good thought for me, but you know, it's like we lived in a little bubble and we didn't know what was going on. They took sides. They had to know what was going on according to this understanding. So it's nice to say it, but let's try to build some of the pieces to put the clues together to make this a little bit more something that you can possibly believe. There's no explicit sources, so in the end you might not come out convinced, and again, I'm okay with that. So number one, just what we've seen, we have this killing between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. Seems a little bit strange and out of context. Maybe there's something broader going on here. Number two, let's look at source number 12. So there's, remember I told you about this story about in the attic of Hananya ben Chizkia, Beis Shammai overtook Beis Hillel in terms of both in terms of the decrees that they made, as well as in these other sources that they actually fought with them. What were the decrees that were being made at that time? So if you look through the Gemara and Shabbos, all of those decrees, or most of those decrees, have to do with rules and laws that separate Jew from non-Jew. And the argument that could be made is that what Beis Shammai was trying to do with these decrees was to put a separation between the Jewish people and the Roman people. We don't want intermingling. We want to set our foot over here and keep them over there. So that's another piece here. Again, it's not overwhelming. People fight, you know, rabbis fight about this all the time. It doesn't just have to be during this time period. But it's another clue that this is something that they were fighting about. Source number 12 is the same Hananya ben Chizkia. In the same context of the Gemara, they say, who wrote this idea of Megillas Tainus? So we'll give you a background on Megillas Tainus. Megillas Tainus was a scroll that discussed days that you were not allowed to fast. Even though Tainus means fast, these are days that you're not allowed to fast. We don't follow any of this anymore. The only day that followed through to our time period from Megillas Tainus that we don't fast is Hanukkah. That's it. All the other dates fall by the wayside. Most of us wouldn't even know any of those days. But in the rabbinic times, this was something that was known. There was a Megillas Tainus. Who wrote this Megillas Tainus? So source number 12, Tanu Rabbanan, Mikas of Megillas Tainus, Amru Hananya ben Chizkia v'Siyasa. This same Hananya ben Chizkia, who was from the Shammai persuasion, Shayu Mechavav in Esatzaros, like a good Jew, liked troubles. I think, the way we have to look at all the Mepharshim, but the way I'm understanding it is that therefore they celebrated the victories, maybe? I don't know. We have to look through all of those sources. So in source number 13, we saw that this one example of one of the days that you're not allowed to fast on was the day that they found out that Caligula died, and therefore they didn't have to go to war over not putting this putting the idol in the temple. If you look at source number 14, so there's another important sage here who's the son of this Hananya ben Chizkia. His name is Elazar ben Hananya ben Chizkia. And tell me if you remember from 2 weeks ago what this source sounds like. The Mechilta and Rabbi Shmuel says, Zachor b'shamor, the Pasuk says, two psukim, one says Zachor when it comes to Shabbos, remember, one says protect. Zachor milafanov, v'shomor milaacharov. So you should remember Shabbos beforehand and protect it afterwards. Mikan omri mosifin ala kodesh. Skip that for now. Go to the middle of that line. Elazar ben Hananya ben Chizkia ben Hananya ben Garo. So that's our guy's son. He did as follows. Zachor es yom haShabbos lekacho. Te zokro mi echad b'Shabbos. You should remember it on the first of Shabbos, meaning Sunday. Shim yismana l'chamana yafa. If you find a nice piece of meat or whatever, save it for Shabbos. What does that remind you of? That was Shammai, right? So here we have a grand student, or maybe a great grand student of Shammai, and this statement is said in his name. The only reason why I'm bringing this out is because we're here in the crux of Shammaiville, right? These are people who are hardcore Beis Shammai people. Hananya ben Chizkia, Elazar ben Hananya ben Chizkia. So who wrote Megillas Tainus? Hananya ben Chizkia. Some sources actually say it was Elazar ben Hananya ben Chizkia wrote Megillas Tainus. What is this Megillas Tainus? So if you go through Megillas Tainus, what are most of the days or a bunch of the days referring to? These were, what? Not Beis Megillas. days where the Hashmonaim were victorious in various battles. Okay? Why would somebody in the times of Beis Shammai want to write a book that says you're not allowed to fast on these great and prosperous and joyous days that Hashmonaim, 150 years beforehand, celebrated and were victorious in these various battles?
Because they're going through the same thing.
If I wanted to tell you that we should be fighting a battle now, I am going to be looking for and pushing up and promoting previous precedents for this happening. And that's what the Hashmonaim did. There was some outside rulers who wanted to enforce their rule on us. We are going to revolt. We're going to fight. Let's celebrate those days and remind ourselves that maybe we should revolt and maybe we should fight. Source number 15, and then we'll wrap it up. Source number 15 is the final pin in this argument about Beis Shammai being the zealots, or one of the final pins. And this is taken from Josephus. Josephus quotes an Elazar, the son of Ananias, which sounds very much like Hanania, if you can't say the Cha, right? Elazar, the son of Hananias, who was a high priest. So what happened? Let's read the whole source. At this time, it was that some of those that principally excited the people to go to war and assault upon a certain fortress called Masada, they took it by treachery and slew the Romans that were there and put others of their own party to keep it. At the same time that the Jews took over Masada, Elazar, the son of Ananias, the high priest, a very bold youth, who was at that time governor of the temple, persuaded those that officiated in the divine service to receive no gift or sacrifice for any foreigner. It was at this point that they decided, no korbanos for the Romans. We're not bringing a sacrifice to the emperor, for the emperor. This, Josephus points, is the beginning of the Romans coming in. This is the beginning of the destruction right here. Because you're not going to bring a sacrifice to me, that's like, you know, it's treachery. You can't do that. You have to do this. You have to bring the sacrifice. You don't, now the war is going to start. So putting all these sources together, you have this Hananiah ben Chizkiah, who might not be, this Elazar ben Hananiah might not be the same Elazar ben Hananiah that we have, but they're in the same time period. They have the same similar name. And we might not trust everything Josephus says as complete fact. We don't know. But if you put all these sources together, it seems that there were at least some people from Beis Shammai who were pro-revolution, pro-war. After the destruction, what happens to Beis Shammai? We don't hear about them. There's nothing. We have arguments from them that we hear that they argued with Beis Hillel, but they don't have any place anymore. After the revolt, there was nothing going on from Beis Shammai's perspective. Last thing to pull together, go to your hand, the other handout. Okay, so this is taken from Rabbi Lau, the Sages. This is, does it say what page it is there?
260.
Okay, so on page 260, where the arrow is, he brings this all together and says, some historians have identified Elazar ben Hananiah as one of the leaders of the great revolt, who upon the outbreak of the revolt discontinued the offering of a sacrifice for the welfare of the emperor. According to this view, the writing of Megillas Tainus was an attempt to enlist the Hashmonaim spirit of rebellion and the cherished memory of glorious events as a source of inspiration in the war against the Romans, a war in which Beis Shammai and his students, including Elazar ben Hananiah and his father, to whom Megillas Tainus is attributed, belong to the war camp. The events recounted in Megillas Tainus provide a wealth of information about the Hashmonaim days of glory, 25th of Kislev, 13th of Adar, 28th of Shvat. These are all things that the Hashmonaim did, the 24th of Iyar, dedication of temple, day of Nicanor, departure from Jerusalem, 24th of years, the conquering of the Chakra fortress in Jerusalem and others, the exile of the Jewish people from their land, however, consigned Megillas Tainus to the dustbin of history. So we don't have it anymore, and Hanukkah is the only thing that we have left over. The impetus for writing a detailed history of the Hasmonaims gave expression to the tension between the two principal rival parties in Jerusalem at the time, the party of rebellion intent upon reigniting the holy fire of the Hasmonaim, and in doing so, rebelling against the Romans, and the conciliatory party that was attempting to adapt to life under Roman rule. The revolutionary party originated in the school of Shammai, which in time would become the breeding ground of the leaders of the great revolt, as mentioned. One of those leaders was Elazar ben Hananya ben Garon, the possible author or co-author of Megillus Tainus. And now, pulling it all together for the final piece. Against this background, we can return to our point of departure. The students of Shammai and Hillel, who failed to apprentice under their teachers. These were the days of upheavals and persecutions and disturbances, in which there was no significant spiritual authority. Days of doubt in which they attempted to prevent the Torah from being divided into number of Torahs. With this in mind, we now proceed to the discussion of Rabbi Gamliel the Elder, which we will not proceed to right now. But his point here is, why, getting back to the original question, why is Hillel's son Shimon not mentioned in Pirkei Avos? Rabbi Lau argues that this, its reflection of the time period, is that the sages at the time did not stand up and were not great leaders. We're going to see some of the leaders of the revolution, of the destruction of the sages during the times of destruction. We're going to see Rav Tzadok, and we're going to see Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. That's going to be on Tisha B'Av, so we're not empty of any leaders. But during this time period, in the early part of the first century CE, towards the building of the destruction, there was nobody. The sages, Beis Shammai, Beis Hillel, they're fighting. These aren't necessarily the people who are going to bring us together. They're two Torahs. They're maybe even killing each other. Whether you take it or you leave it is up to you. But what we saw today was that perhaps the machlokes between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel is a broader machlokes. Is about, do we fight or do we not? Now it's easy to look back and say, oh, Beis Shammai were zealous, they shouldn't have fought. Hasmonaim fought and they won. Right? Rabbi Akiva sides with Bar Kokhba. Right? Fighting, we don't always have to be passive. Sometimes fighting is good. And this is a contemporary debate. Do we fight in Israel or are we passive? It's the same. This stream runs through, starting from Hasmonaim to the Great Revolt, to Bar Kokhba, and now reignited now. Do we just go under the reign of the other governments and just do whatever they tell us to do? Or do we rebel? Do we revolt? Do we have our own independence and own identity as a Jewish people in the state of Israel? These are no easy questions. In the Hasmonaim realm, we won. This one we didn't win. Bar Kokhba we didn't win. Hopefully now, we continue to win with the state of Israel. And Hashem should protect us and provide the support that we need to continue to do this. But this is a broad and important question leading up to destruction. We will continue this discussion on Tuesday. And if you're not here Tuesday, that's okay. We'll pick up with regular Pirkei Avos next week on Sunday morning.